papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis. What's going on in American newsrooms from a local perspective here in the WAMC listening area? I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now with the Upstate American, and I'd like to introduce my colleagues around the table here in the studio. Judy Patrick is here, the former editor of the Daily Gazette, now vice president of the New York Press Association. That is your cue to say something, Judy.
We are gathered here today on this Thanksgiving
Thank
week.
Thank you very much. And here actually is her successor, Miles Reed, the editor of the Daily Gazette. How about that?
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Rex.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you can take time away from the newsroom. This is not an easy thing these days.
It is not easy. We're all hands on deck.
And speaking of stepping away from the newsroom, here's Ian Pickus, the news director of Northeast Public Radio. A few steps down from your newsroom. You can handle this, right?
I hope so. This reminds me of when I was just getting started in journalism and I had my substitute teaching job on the side. I'm a substitute today. Who canceled?
That's right. Barbara Lombardo is hoarse. And so Ian has stepped in, and that's a good thing. And we're hoping that Barbara gets her voice back so we can hear her again next week. You know, you made reference to the fact that we are speaking here in Thanksgiving time and before we all lapse into our tryptophan-induced lolling about. Let's take a moment to just think about some of the good things, actually. Maybe there are things actually in journalism that we're thankful for. Stuff that bears speaking to the power of journalism still. I'd start off just by saying that I think that the emerging not-for-profit journalism sector is doing such great work around the country, especially on a local level or in New York State. I'm connected to New York Focus, which is a statewide not-for-profit. There are those in 50 states, actually. And I just think that there's so much vitality that is going on in journalism, notwithstanding the financial challenges here.
There's a lot of collegiality in the industry now that might be relatively new, at least in the way that I experience it. And we're all competitive and we want to be first and we want to do well and we want to have good ratings and we want to win awards and so on. But I do notice that there's almost a sort of esprit de corps among the survivors who are sticking it out right now in this highly challenging time. We're kind of rooting for each other. Sometimes we're helping each other. Sometimes we're working on joint projects. And that's been relatively new, at least in the time that I've been in this field. And I hope we see more of it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Ian. In fact, some of the efforts that we have going forward in the next year, we're applying for philanthropic money. And some of the criteria that we have in some of these applications, they actually want partnerships and groups to work together. So we're going to revisit a longstanding unofficial relationship we had with CBS6 in Schenectady. For years, we were unofficially their news gathering partners, and Judy was involved for a lot of those years. We sort of let that wane, and right now we're going to bring it back. Actually, I have a meeting set up with the gentleman who runs that station now, Steve Grissom, in a few weeks to take a look at that, because I think there is a lot of this collegiality, and I think it's the way we can do it. You know, share resources and contact. You and I, Ian, sometimes do that. Doesn't mean we don't compete all the time.
When I'm desperate.
We're competing with news for news, but I think that's going to be the way forward here. So,
you know, as Thanksgiving has approached, I've been really thinking about this, what to be thankful for. I took a step back and thought, I'm really thankful for the persistence of reporters. I mean, a lot of people were very upset by the Trump election and it checked out. But you know what? Those reporters, they are back at work. They are plugging away. And you would have thought that there would be some fatigue because they had just covered this really very intense election. But no, they're out there. They're still plugging away. They're still filing those stories. They're doing the in-depth pieces. And that's what reporters do. and editors do. The next day, you got to put out another paper. The next day, you got to put out another news broadcast. They just keep coming at you, and the people in our field keep fulfilling their duties. And so I'm pretty thankful for every one of them. The people who are in Sudan writing stories about famine, the people who are in Ukraine covering the war, sometimes those jobs aren't glorious or aren't very rewarding. And God knows nobody makes a lot of money in this field, but they're at it because they care about getting at the truth and doing the job. So I'm really thankful for them.
Absolutely. Just to echo that, you can't say that because Donald Trump attacks reporters, you therefore back off the coverage. 77 million people voted for Donald Trump, and they and the 76 million who did not equally deserve coverage. And when the people at the Trump rallies turn and attack the journalists at Trump's urging, that is hard to stand there and to still go out and wade into the crowd and interview people. I've been in situations where I've been facing a hostile group who doesn't want to have you there. You know, that's very uncomfortable. You worry about your own safety sometimes. And so that even in America, the intrepid reporters are still at the job, which is really a terrific thing. And there is another generation coming. Now, the fact is, student journalists around the country are doing great work. You know, the one that stands out down at the University of Florida, there's a newspaper called The Independent Alligator. Maybe it's the Independent Student Alligator. I don't know. Anyway, that was where they uncovered the information about Ben Sasse, the former Nebraska senator who became the president of the University of Florida. And then it was discovered by the student journalists that he had put a lot of his political cronies on the payroll, that he had extraordinary expenses in traveling and so on. He ended up resigning, saying he had to spend time with his wife. So the next generation coming is somebody who ought to be grateful for, too. That's really cool. You're still teaching, are you, Ian?
Yes, and I'm having the experience this semester of teaching online, which is where a lot of these kids are all day long. And you do see some real bright spots. They're not jaded in the same way that people who've been in it for a while are, and they're really going to be the future. There's no question about it. In our industry, it's increasingly unlikely that someone will spend, you know, 30, 40 years in a newsroom and retire in glory. So there's a lot of pressure on the next class who's coming up, 22, 23, with a lot of energy and inquisitiveness to move us forward.
The fact is, journalists are outnumbered 7-1 by PR people in this country now. So most of those young journalists will go off to jobs where they can make more money in public relations or even lobbying, for example. But we hope that while they're doing the job, while they're in the trenches, so to speak, that they are able to deliver and do that tough fact-checking, the tough work of real journalism that this is all about.
If anything, I think I've seen a little bit of a pendulum swift just in the last couple of years, and I think it's a result of this tumultuous period of time that we've been in politics in America and the division. I have sensed that there is a renewed, you know, whether it's the Watergate moment of our time, I think I've seen this renewed resurgence. I've seen more applications just in the last year, I think, than I had seen for a handful of years. So I'm pretty hopeful. And students are coming to apply to us with a renewed sense that they want to do accountability journalism. Again, not that it ever went away, but I think it's coming back. I just hired somebody, a recent graduate of Syracuse University, and we've assigned her to the paper in Gloversville in Fulton County, and she wants to do hard-nosed accountability journalism. She's not saying, oh, I want to do, you know, glamour and entertainment things, which is appealing, right, on the TikTok generation. She wants to do hard-nosed journalism, and so I'm, you know, excited about it.
The challenge there, of course, I mean, having been in your situation, the challenge is that when a journalist wants to do that, the difficulty is to be sure they don't cut corners, right? We've been in a situation where you get a young journalist who wants to do that and thinks that using powerful words as opposed to deep reporting is how you get into tough
Absolutely.
Journalism.
That is certainly the challenge. And I think careful editing, careful guidance will be something that's so important. And I think it'll be a process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the challenge for our industry going forward as we want to tap into that young generation. How to merge the needs of legacy media, for example, with the wants and desires of kids in college who want to do, you know, really good accountability journalism, which is difficult and sometimes needs a little bit of training, a little bit of wisdom to guide them. So it's extra work for everybody involved, but it's our future. We need to do it without turning them off. You know, I was at a seminar recently where the university professors who are working with the young students, they are worried about sending this new crop out into the world and asking them to cover planning board and zoning board and school boards, when in many respects, that's what the hyper-local information that the local media is looking for. So there's that disconnect that we need to address.
You mean they think the kids don't know what they're looking at? They don't understand how local governments work to be able to do that?
Right. And to them, it's boring and irrelevant to what they view as news. And why are we writing this? And who really cares about that? And those are really good questions for us to address, because maybe that's not relevant and maybe nobody does care. Or maybe we're just covering it in a wrong way.
Well, and the point is, so many places aren't covering it at all. I mean, that's really what we've lost in the U.S. with the decline of medium and small newspapers is, you know, the New York Times did pretty well in the last decade and they shattered records. But what about all those papers where there was one person who went to the school board meeting and now there's zero?
And the New York Times is doing well because they have recipes and they have Wirecutter and they have all these ancillary products.
Games,
terrific stuff. They're not really doing exceptionally well with the hyperlocal coverage of the South Bronx. And that has always been the case. That's always been the challenge they've faced. And it's the challenge that we all face because we all have too few people to cover what needs to be covered. That has always been so, even when there were a lot of reporters. In my little town in Rensselaer County where I live, I get a lot of news from a local would-be politician, somebody who really wants to get elected to office and who monitors the planning board and the town board and sends a little newsletter to people. Now, this is biased coverage, right? It's somebody with a point of view, but there's also a lot of factual information being presented there that I'm not getting because there is no newspaper covering that community anymore. For the young people, it's difficult because they don't have the example of digesting that kind of news in their homes. I saw a study that said that 40% of young Americans get their news from influencers. And influencers tend to be people who basically have a political point of view largely from the right. So if that's where young people are accustomed to getting their news, you can't expect them to understand why it matters to cover a planning board meeting, which is making decisions about their local communities. All right. Well, we were saying we're grateful for that kind of thing. We're grateful for the young people coming up, and notwithstanding the challenge of what's happening. Some employers are trying to add staff. I know one of the stories that we looked at as we were preparing for this show has to do with the Scripps chain of television stations. EW Scripps is a company that used to have a lot of newspapers as well as TV stations, and now they have made a decision around the country. They're adding 250 journalists in their local newsrooms. That is a 67% increase by the end of the year to try to have more local coverage on television, which is essential because that's the way a lot of people get their information. That's rare. I don't know why we don't see that more, or do we see that more around here?
I love that. I love the idea that they're doing that. And one of the things they're also doing is shifting away from the anchors and the presenters and putting more money and more resources into reporters in the field. Let's hope it works for them. And I have my fingers crossed on this one, that it drives viewership, that it drives clicks on their website, that it drives engagement, that this approach could be a standard that other broadcast stations could look at and say, yeah, this works. Local news works. If you give people interesting information about their communities, they will pay attention. And they also have that wonderful spelling contest, correct?
Yes, they do.
Just like the New York Times.
I think it's incredibly, encouraging. There is one sort of distressing thing that sort of to watch with this is that the early results with those stations are that their ratings are down and they're losing out to some of these other stations in their markets that are sticking to those things where they do stand-ups and they cover crime and the kind of flashy things that TV news has traditionally done. So the big question, I think, is can Scripps and other organizations think more in terms of the long game? And that's certainly what we're trying to do, and not knee-jerk react to, you know, any of the kind of criticism that everybody in the media is getting from the right now, that it's all fake news and it's slanted and it's the woke left media. But the Scripps sort of experiment, let's see how it goes, because we all know that there's that temptation when you lead a new news organization, as soon as things like ratings go down or subscriptions cancel, then potentially you have somebody upstairs who comes knocking and says, why are we doing this? And so it will be certainly a big test.
Scripps is lucky because their CEO started as a reporter, which is rare. You know, most CEOs come from the business side of things, so maybe they'll be able to withstand it. But yeah, I think you have a good point. It reminds me of the time of the effort about a decade ago of a one of the local major TV stations in Chicago to focus on good news. They were going to have some good news segments all the time. Carol Marin was the anchor who led this effort and did not work. They persisted for about 18 months and decided that just didn't really have the edge that people were looking for. So that was an effort also that was failing. But I think that anytime you try to skew your news coverage in a particular direction, oh, let's see what's good today, as opposed to let's see what's real today, you're running the risk of actually not doing your job.
We've talked a lot about this show on the about the profit imperative, and that is essentially at odds with a lot of the kind of reporting that communities may need, but also may not want to click on.
Mm-hmm. Even if you don't have the profit imperative, though, there still is the audience imperative,
yeah,
which affects here. I mean, we've been hearing some criticism of NPR. Of course, when don't you hear criticism of NPR or any of us about how supposedly from the left we hear, oh, there's this effort at balance that normalizes the abnormal cabinet picks of Donald Trump, because NPR used phrases that, like, for example, Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary nominee, he has a background that is different from what people have come to expect. Well, yes, different indeed as a TV anchor. I mean, that's a euphemism for saying he's, I think the left would want us to say he's wholly unqualified. That's not fair either.
And possibly sympathetic to Christian nationalism.
Yes, that too. Oh, so you need to report all that stuff. The nominee for energy secretary, NPR's reporting said that he had expressed doubts about whether climate change is driving extreme weather events. Well, that sounds, yes, okay, he has doubts. He actually has been outrageous. He says, there is no climate crisis, and we are not in the midst of an energy transition either. Well, that's outrageous. That's ignorant, is what that is.
I felt a little defensive of NPR after this article, to be honest with you, because I think there's a dynamic happening here that a lot of people are in denial about, which is Donald Trump won the election, and the people he wants to be in these positions are going to be in those positions for the most part. And so we've been having conversations here about how do you cover that? You cover with criticism, you question statements, like always, without becoming the knee-jerk sort of reactionary news outlet that's leading a resistance, because that's not our job either. And we've all gone through one term of this. And as we're speaking, you know, an entire news cycle is being dominated by a tweet about 25% tariffs. We've kind of seen this movie before. But I hear criticism, and this article we read is similar too, which is, well, don't give these people airtime. You know, don't play Trump's statements. That ship has left the station, okay? Or that train has left the station, and it's not coming back.
You know, whoever left the station. Yeah, so you can't take that approach, right? You
no.
can't.
So what are you going to do? Say, oh, well, Pete Hegseth, who is the defense secretary, is not being covered on our news outlet because it's potentially ridiculous that he's in the position? You can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is such a confusing time for the media because they don't know how far to go. But what I'm seeing, that if you pay a lot of attention and spend a lot of time, you will find all these things out about these potential nominees. The problem is it doesn't neatly package into a one story or one news broadcast. You know, I feel great sympathy for anybody who has to try to put out a story nowadays because it's a patchwork. The only way you can really get at the truth is to do this patchwork, because you cannot go through every time you talk about Pete has exit. You can't go through all the things he's done, all the books he's written, all of the major problems people have with his, you know, potential with his nomination. I mean, this is just the start of the nomination process too. So this is going to be with us for a while. And trust me, there's going to be more of this coming down the pike. And how do we handle this? It is not a fine line between being truth tellers and being, apologists or being right-wing reactionaries. We just have to, stick to the facts, and we should be okay. But Ian, you're still going to be getting those calls because you get those calls nonetheless.
I think that's fine. And the calls are welcome. It means people care. But the point is, we can't say this coverage is going to lead to X expected outcome. That's where I think there's just a lot of wishful thinking on the part of an audience.
It's speculation. And that's and so often cable news shows are just fueled by speculation, and people have come to expect it.
You know, I think when A. Martinez or Leila Fadel at NPR turn the mic and they do these interviews with these nominees, I actually think it's serving a purpose. And I agree with Judy in terms of, if you look at the broad scope of coverage, I think Americans who are willing to put some time into it and look at a variety of them can get a good sense of a candidate or a nominee. And in the case of these presidential appointees and nominees, I think that allowing them to say such a statement that is, we know, is factually incorrect, it's educational. It lets the public know that this person has this belief. Ideally, in that same segment, if they can fact check it, is good. If they can't, though, if you look at the broad spectrum of NPR coverage, for example, or the New York Times, if you are willing to look at all of the coverage, I think you get a better sense of these candidates and nominees, and you're informed. And I think that's a good thing, rather than saying, as Ian said, oh, we're just not going to have them on. We're not going to give them a platform. We're not going to allow it. That, to me, is irresponsible, because that plays into this idea that the woke media is shutting down these other side voices.
Yes. There are journalism strategies that you can take, and NPR took one, actually, during the first Trump administration. There had been a trend of doing live interviews with newsmakers, anchors sitting in a studio, newsmakers sitting wherever they were doing a live interview. And I think it was when Nancy Barnes became the head of NPR News. She's now the editor of the Boston Globe. She said, less of these live interviews, more back and forth perhaps with reporters. And I notice you're doing more of that now, Ian, here at WAMC, the reporters going on live with the anchor to talk about a news story. More of that, or more of recorded interviews where you can do fact checks. But when you have a live interview with a newsmaker in what you know is going to be a 3-minute segment, that gives the newsmaker an opportunity to just keep talking and not speak truth necessarily.
Right. This was the idea of the truth sandwich, which Stevens keep brought to the table. And you know what? Let's be fair. That doesn't always work either. I mean, he got that much vaunted interview with Donald Trump after he had left the White House, and they kind of truth sandwiched it, and Trump hung up on NPR. That's all they got.
Oh, well. Next time. But you think about how to cover these situations. There's a wonderful reporter named Allison Mitchell, who used to be the Albany bureau chief for Newsday, one of my predecessors. That was a job I had. And Newsday was a big, rich newspaper. So Allison, after being here in the Albany bureau, went down to the Washington bureau, where she was at a great disadvantage, because if you're Newsday in the state capitol in those days, you could get anybody to talk to you. In Washington, she couldn't. And she made this point. She said, if the Assistant Secretary of Defense, who I need on a story, comes back to his desk after lunch. He's got all these, in those days it was pink slips, while you were out. He's got a call from CBS News and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and Newsday. He's not going to call back Newsday. But if you can get to the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, it really forced her to get deeper into sourcing, to find people who are actually on the cusp of making decisions, who were deeper into the networks. It made her a better reporter, she said, because she didn't have the immediate access that a Bob Woodward would have, say, or someone else like that. Similarly, this is a notion put forward by Joel Simon, who used to run Committee to Protect Journalists, in an article that we were reading about how foreign correspondents have an approach. They have to be humble. They have to embed themselves in organizations to find out what's going on. And that is often the way that you need to cover a situation. And maybe that's how you cover the Trump world going forward. You just get completely embedded into it and with the humility that you need to bring to something as a reporter.
Yeah, for any of us, I would recommend going to the media outlet for in any other country and see what they're writing about U.S. politics or U.S. government or U.S. action abroad, because it's such a different perspective and gives you a whole nother take on what we're doing and how we're perceived around the world. Wonderful news coverage.
The question is, with the recriminations that are promised, will the Trump administration seek to limit press access and the traditional avenues? I mean, we saw this in the first term around when, you know, the Washington Post was banned from the press plane and so on. And that might force some reporters to jump through some hoops that they might not otherwise have done.
Mm-hmm. And force them to get more creative. And that, again, is like with the foreign correspondents. There may be more risk to the reporting. There may be more efforts to get around officialdom because officialdom isn't dealing with you. That's the way it is in a foreign country as well. So it's to be expected. This is going to be a difficult time for journalists in the years ahead, but...
You know, one of our favorite tools, the Freedom of Information Act, that allows us access to records and documents, you know, it's always been difficult to get information from the local, state, and federal governments. And I expect that that's really going to slow down under the Trump administration as well. I mean, there have been many laws that they flout. And I, again, it's not exclusive to Republican administrations or to Donald Trump and his administration. People have been doing this to us since they enacted these laws at the state and federal level, but I expect it's going to get worse.
And we will keep at it. And that is the message.
We are done?
Just for now.
Just for now. We'll be back again next week. Isn't that something? That was Judy Patrick. We're grateful to Miles Reed for also being here. And Ian Pickus, the news director, our host here at WAMC. I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Dave Agostina. We hope to come back again next week for The Media Project.
They all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, WAMC news director Ian Pickus, and editor and vice president of the Daily Gazette, Miles Reed. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustino. Thanks for listening.
Circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.